Some cases close with a confession, some close with a conviction, and some never really close at all. The Grimes Tapes is a detective fiction series following Detective Sarah Grimes as she works the cases that don't fit neatly into a file. Cases where power, politics, and human nature collide. And the truth is, the last thing anyone wants found. Episode 4, Cracks. Claire Brannick kept files. 31 years of child welfare cases and buried in the paperwork. A trail that leads somewhere no one expected. Grimes follows it. She doesn't like where it goes. Claire Brannick, born Claire Harmon, had been a social worker for the Pennsylvania Department of Child Welfare for 31 years. Her employment records arrived in a manila envelope thick enough to use as a doorstop, and Grimes spread them across her desk the way she would a crime scene, methodically, looking for what didn't fit. The career was exemplary. Commendations, awards, the kind of file that human resources departments use in training materials as an example of what dedication looks like. Claire had managed caseloads that would have broken most people, handled the particular horrors of the child welfare system, the neglect, the abuse, the institutional failures that ground children into statistics, and done it with a consistency that bordered on the mechanical. But there were gaps. Not large ones, not the kind that screamed something wrong here, just small absences, a personal day here, a case file that seemed thinner than it should be, a transfer between offices that happened without the usual paperwork trail. The kind of gaps that only looked like gaps if you were looking for them, and Grimes was looking. One gap in particular caught her eye. Over 20 years ago, Claire had been assigned to a case in Whitfield County, the same county that showed up in Tom's search history, the same county where the law office was. The case file was sealed, which in child welfare usually meant a minor was involved, but the summary notation was visible. Infant removal, emergency placement, case closed. Three phrases that told a story so ordinary in the child welfare system that nobody would look twice. Babies were removed from unsafe homes every day. They were placed with families every day. Cases were closed every day. The system churned, and the children it processed became other people's problems or other people's children, and the files went into boxes, and the boxes went into storage, and storage went into forgetting. But this case had no corresponding adoption record, no court filing, no termination of parental rights, no placement documentation. The baby had been removed and then nothing, as if the child had been erased from the system mid-sentence. Grimes called Whitfield County, spent 40 minutes on hold, was transferred three times, finally reached an archive clerk who confirmed that yes, there was a sealed case from that year, and no, she couldn't unseal it without a court order, but she could confirm that the caseworker assigned was Claire Harmon, and the case involved an infant born to a 14-year-old mother who had died in childbirth, and the infant had been placed with the maternal grandmother and her second husband, pending a more permanent arrangement. And the permanent arrangement? The file just says case closed. There's no adoption finalized, no transfer of custody documented. It's like someone started the paperwork and never finished it. Or never intended to finish it. The clerk had nothing to add to that. Grimes hung up and stared at the ceiling for a long time. She requested a full court order to unseal the case file. Then she called the forensic lab about the second laptop. The laptop had taken 10 days to crack, The password was 12 characters, and the tech who opened it, a careful young man named Reyes, apologized for the delay as if he'd kept her waiting for dinner. He sent the contents by secure file transfer. Grimes printed what mattered and read it at her desk while the squad room ran its ordinary machinery around her. Claire had kept notes, not official ones, not the kind that went into a case file or through the system. Personal notes, in a document she'd apparently been adding to for years. Case numbers, not names. A county designation. Dates, scattered like breadcrumbs across two decades. And one notation that stopped Grimes entirely, because it was dated in the final weeks of Claire's life. "He's looking, let it be." She read it three times. "He's looking, let it be." Claire had known Tom was searching. She'd written it down and said nothing. She'd been dead by the time Tom found his way to whatever had gotten him killed. Grimes put the printout in her file. Then she looked at the archive clerk's note about the Whitfield case, one sibling noted in the household, and pulled out the phone book she still kept in her bottom drawer, the one she used for its genuine weight when she needed to think, and set it on top of the pile. A social worker who had kept private records of a stolen child for 20 years. A husband who found out after she died and drove into the city to make it right. A name on a legal pad, Ellis, that meant nothing yet. And somewhere in Whitfield County, a family with a shape she couldn't see clearly. She needed someone who'd been there. Tracking Diane Prescott took most of a day. The State Welfare Department's retiree registry listed her as Diane M. Prescott, retired 12 years prior, last known address in Lackawanna County. The phone number on file rang to a disconnected tone. A neighbor listed as emergency contact had moved. The forwarding address in the registry pointed to a mail drop that turned out to be a UPS store on Wyoming Avenue in Scranton, staffed by a teenager who confirmed packages were forwarded, but not where. Grimes left her card. 40 minutes later, a woman called from a different number and said, "You left a card at the UPS store. I'm Diane Prescott. What is this about?" "It's about Claire Harmon," Grimes said, "and a case she worked in Whitfield County." A long pause. "I'm not in Lackawanna. I'm in Scranton proper. I can't talk on the phone about this." She gave Grimes an address. Diane Prescott had retired from child welfare 12 years ago and now lived in a duplex in Scranton with three cats and an extensive collection of ceramic owls. She was 71, sharp as a tack, and deeply suspicious of anyone with a badge who showed up at her door asking about old cases. "I don't talk about cases," Diane said, standing in her doorway with her arms crossed and her chin up. Behind her, the hallway was lined with ceramic owls on narrow shelves, round-eyed, watchful, arranged by size. "Those children have a right to privacy." "I understand that. This is a murder investigation. A man is dead, and his son is in a cell for something I don't believe he did." "What's that got to do with Claire?" "I think Claire may have known the son's biological family, professionally, through her work." Something moved in Diane's face. Not the suspicion, which stayed, but something moving in alongside it, a weight shifting. "Come in," she said. "I'll make tea." They sat in a living room where every horizontal surface held a ceramic owl. Diane served tea in mismatched cups without asking if Grimes wanted any, and for a long moment she didn't say anything at all, just held her cup in both hands and looked at the largest owl on the mantle as if asking its opinion. "Claire was meticulous," Diane said finally. "That's the first thing you should know. Whatever she did in her career, she didn't do it carelessly. She thought things through." "What did you know about the Whitfield case?" "At the time? Almost nothing. It was her case, her county. I was in a different office." Diane set down her cup. "What I knew was that she was bothered by something. She wouldn't say what. Claire didn't talk about her cases, even with colleagues, but she was bothered. I could tell because she got quiet in a particular way she had when something was eating at her. She'd been working that region for a while, and then one week she was different. Off, like she'd seen something she couldn't unsee." "Did she say anything?" She said once, and this was at lunch, offhand, the way you'd say anything, that there were situations where the system just wasn't going to help, where you could follow every rule and a child would still end up in the wrong place. She wasn't asking me anything, she was just saying it into the air. Diane paused. I've thought about that a lot over the years, whether she'd already decided something when she said it. Did you know she took a personal day? Diane looked at her. Which one? A Tuesday in November, that year. She came back different. A long silence. One of the cats entered the room, considered Grimes, and left. Yes, Diane said. I noticed that. She was, I can only say lighter, like she'd set something down. I asked her how she was, and she said fine, better. I thought maybe she and Tom had had some good news. She stopped. She'd been trying to have children for years, I knew that. And then, a few months later, she had a baby. A private adoption, she said. Everything handled through an attorney. Did you ask for details? I congratulated her. That's what you do. The baby was real and she was happy, and it wasn't my business to interrogate a colleague about where her child came from. But you thought about it. Diane looked at the owl on the mantle again. I thought about it, years later. During a system migration, we were digitizing old files. I pulled the Whitfield case and noticed the placement was never finalized. The baby had been in temporary custody, and then the file just closed. No transfer, no adoption, no placement. The child stopped being in the system. She folded her hands. The timing was about right. Did you report it? No, Diane said it plainly without apology. I thought about Claire, about the baby, a real child, real parents who loved him. And I thought about the family in Whitfield, whatever was happening in that home. The mother was dead, the child was safe. The system had failed in the right direction, maybe, for once. She looked at Grimes directly. I know that's not a satisfying answer for a detective. It's an honest one. Grimes closed her notebook. One more question. Was there someone else in the household? A sibling? The case file would tell you more than I could. I didn't know the family. I only knew Claire was worried about the placement, that the grandmother was overwhelmed, that the step-grandfather wasn't kind, that the home wasn't right. She paused. She mentioned once there was an older brother. She didn't say much about him. Grimes wrote it down, drank the last of her tea, thanked Diane Prescott and drove back to the city with the radio off and the highway unreeling in front of her and the number on Tom's legal pad, Ellis, sitting in the back of her mind where things sat when they were almost something. At her desk, she pulled up what she had on the Whitfield County birth records. She'd subpoenaed them separately from the case file, and they'd come in that morning. The public certificate confirmed the basics. Infant male, unnamed, born to a mother listed as Lily, age 14. Father, unknown. Maternal grandmother and her second husband listed as interim guardians. One other family member in the household at time of placement, a brother, 21. The name on the birth record wasn't Ellis, but the case file cross-reference number on Tom's legal pad matched the Whitfield County notation in Claire's laptop notes. And Tom had written Ellis at the top of that page and underlined it twice. First name, last name. She didn't know yet. But the shape was there. A young woman who died, a baby who vanished, a household with an older brother the social worker had been worried about, and Tom Brannick driving into the city with that name written on a legal pad and someone meeting him at the hotel before he could eat his hamburger. She printed the birth record, added it to the file, wrote a note, request unsealing of Whitfield case file, court order pending. Then she looked across the squad room at Callahan. He was on the phone. She could tell from the angle of his chair that the call had already changed register. He'd been working through supplementals when it rang, and his posture had shifted in a way she'd learned to read over 16 months. Pen down, shoulders still. The particular stillness of a man receiving information that requires him to not react. She watched him, not directly. She worked. She initialed a form. She picked up her coffee and set it down. He wrote nothing. When he set the phone down, he sat at his desk for a long time. She stopped pretending not to watch. The squad room ran its ordinary business around him: phones, keyboards, someone's radio too loud at the far end, and Callahan sat in the middle of it like a stone that had fallen into shallow water. Hardly any ripple. But he wasn't moving. 11 minutes, she counted from when he set the phone down. She wasn't sure why she counted. It was the kind of detail that settled into memory whether you wanted it to or not. Then he stood. He walked to her desk. He set the lab report face up in front of her without saying anything first. She read it. The autosomal profile from the evidentiary sample, the material recovered from the victim's fingernails, did not match the reference sample for Nathan Brannick. YSTR consistent, indicating same paternal lineage. Autosomal markers, definitively different. Not Nathan Brannick's DNA. A supplemental note below. The reference sample, Nathan Brannick's own DNA profile, showed elevated homozygosity across multiple loci, characteristic of a person whose biological parents were closely related, potentially first-degree relatives. She read it once, twice. She set it down. "It's not Nate," she said. "It's not Nate. It's a paternal relative." She paused. "And Nate's own profile, his biological parents were closely related." "Yes." She looked at the photograph of Tom's legal pad pinned to the board she kept on the edge of her desk. The single name, underlined twice. "Ellis," she said. Callahan's jaw moved slightly, the way it moved when he was biting down on something. He looked at the photograph. He looked at the lab report. He did not say anything else, and Grimes did not say anything else, and the squad room continued its noise around them as if nothing had shifted. But the board had just been knocked off its easel, and all the pieces were in the air, waiting to see where they'd land. The visitor came on a Thursday. Nate had stopped counting days the way you stop counting miles on a treadmill. The number changed, but nothing else did. His cell was the same 7x10. The light was the same institutional nothing, a flat, buzzing presence that prevented darkness rather than providing actual light. The food arrived on the same plastic trays at the same hours, and he ate it or he didn't, and the trays went back the same either way. Janet came twice a week. She had a pattern: motions filed, motions denied, evidence building, counsel considering options. Her voice had the careful calibration of someone who delivered bad news professionally and had learned which words were steps and which were holes. Nate had learned to listen for the holes. In between her visits, there wasn't much. There was the ceiling, the 7x10, the exercise yard where he stood in a corner because standing in the corner meant no one had to walk around him. He wasn't afraid, exactly. Or he was, but it had settled into a lower register, background noise his body had adjusted to. The acute fear had burned out sometime in the second week. What was left was more like a long, low sound he couldn't locate. He thought about Claire's photo. When they'd processed him, after the second arrest, after the scuffle on the roadside, they'd taken everything: wallet, keys, his phone, a few dollars in his jacket pocket. And the photograph he'd taken from Tom's house, still tucked in his inside jacket pocket where he'd put it without thinking. Claire holding him as a baby, both of them squinting into summer sun. They'd logged it with everything else, put it in a plastic bag, labeled the bag, evidence property. He didn't know which shelf it was on or which room. Somewhere in this building. He had not been allowed to keep it. He had not asked if he could keep it. He hadn't thought to ask until after, and then the asking felt too small to say out loud in a place where everything was already too small. But he knew it was here. That was something, maybe. The photo was in the building. The visitor wasn't Janet. Nate recognized Garza from the funeral, Claire's funeral, where the Dunmore department had turned out in dress uniforms and stood in a row. Garza had spoken to Nate afterward, briefly, with the particular compressed sympathy of a man who understood grief but dealt in efficiency. "Your dad's a good man. We're all here for him." Now Garza was here on the other side of the glass, in plain clothes, looking at Nate with something that was harder to interpret than sympathy. "I'm not supposed to be here," Garza said. "Okay. I've been a cop for 22 years. That means I've been wrong about people, and I've learned what it feels like before I know I'm wrong. That feeling I have right now, sitting here, looking at you." Nate waited. "Your detective, the one working the case, Grimes, she's been asking about your mother, about Claire's work, old files, before you were born." Garza turned his coffee cup in his hands, a styrofoam thing that wasn't coffee anymore. "Tom was up at the station a few times after Claire passed, which wasn't unusual. He'd stop by when he was in town, grab coffee, check in. But these last few months, he was pulling files." "What files?" "That's the thing. Not his. Not anything he'd worked. Old files. Nothing he'd worked. Social services records from other jurisdictions, referrals, that kind of thing. We just figured he was keeping busy, you know? Men like Tom, they don't do well with empty time after a loss. We figured it was one of those projects you invent because you need somewhere to put your hands." Garza paused. "But then your detective starts asking about Claire's caseload, about Whitfield County, about a specific time frame." He looked at Nate directly. "How much did your folks tell you about where they got you?" Nate felt something that wasn't quite a sound. "What do you mean, where they got me?" Garza's face shifted. He had the look of a man who'd taken a step and felt the floor move. "You know, when they adopted, when they had you, how they—" He stopped. "They didn't adopt me. I'm their kid." "Right." Garza said it too quickly. "Sure, I'm asking it wrong." He set the styrofoam cup down on the counter. He looked at the glass. "I'm asking the wrong thing. Forget it. I shouldn't be here." "You came here to ask me something, and now you're backing out of it." "I came because my gut told me to. My gut doesn't always know when to shut up." He stood. He looked at Nate through the glass for a moment longer than he needed to. "You don't look like him," he said. "Tom, you never did look like him. I always thought it was Claire's side. Some families are like that. You get one parent's everything and the other parent's nothing. I used to joke about it with Tom, actually, that you got Claire's eyes and nobody else's genes." He picked up his jacket from the back of the chair. "Probably nothing. Probably I'm just an old cop who can't let things alone. I hope I'm wrong about what I think might be happening. For your sake, kid, I really do." He left. The door behind him closed with the soft industrial click of a room designed to contain things. Nate sat with the glass between him and an empty chair. The thing was, it wasn't a clear thought. It wasn't a revelation. It was more like something he'd always been able to see out of the corner of his eye, but never looked at directly. Because you don't look directly at things that are just there. Part of the furniture. Part of the background. He didn't look like Tom. People had always said he had Claire's eyes, and Tom would say, "Yeah, definitely Claire's side." And nobody examined that statement because why would you? Families passed features around in ways that made no genetic sense. Cousins who looked like siblings, siblings who looked like strangers. You didn't audit the logic of your own face. But Garza had said it differently. You don't look like him. Not the warm version, not the "you got Claire's eyes" version. The version that came with a long look and an unfinished sentence and a retreat. Grimes was asking about Claire's work, about Whitfield County, about before Nate was born. Tom had been pulling welfare case files at the station, not his own cases, someone else's, before you were born. Nate tried to put the pieces into a shape that made sense and couldn't. The pieces didn't refuse to fit, they just produced something he couldn't look at, the same way you couldn't look at a bright light directly. His brain kept sliding off to one side of it. Claire used to say he had piano player's fingers. "God only knows where you got those," she'd say. "Not from us." He'd always taken it as one of those things families say. Warm, affectionate, the mild comedy of biology being random. He reached for it now and it sat differently. "Not from us." He lay down on the cot and stared at the ceiling with its fluorescent indifference and thought about Tom driving to the city before he was killed. Not to see Nate, not for any reason Nate had ever been given. pulling files that weren't his. Something Garza couldn't finish saying. A detective asking about the months before Nate was born. He didn't know what any of it added up to. He genuinely didn't know. He reached for a shape and his hands came back empty. But the question sat in the room with him, the way Garza's question sat in the room after he left. Why you didn't look like him? It didn't ring like a struck bell. It hummed, low and persistent, the sound the institutional light made when the ward went quiet at night. He turned onto his side. He thought about the photograph in its evidence bag on its numbered shelf. Claire's face, squinting into summer sun, her hands around a baby that was supposed to be hers. Was I, though? He thought, and then pulled back from the edge of that question as if from something hot, and lay very still until the thought settled down into the hum of everything else he couldn't explain.